I'll call the work session to order. It'll be a work session until we get a quorum. We're expecting a bare quorum of 8 members of the commission. And to assist in the transcribing of this, I'd like each person to state their name and say a few words so that the people doing the transcribing will hear enough of your voice that later when they hear the voice, they know who's going to be speaking. So maybe I can start. I'm Brian Rogers, and chairing the commission, and this is my voice.
I'm Mary Nordale, a member of the commission, and when we get to the resolution on the permanent fund amendments to the Constitution, I'd like to address some of the issues that are raised there.
Okay. Judy?
I'm Judy Brady. I'm a member of the commission, and this is my voice.
Anna Lee? Do you want to say
Anna Lee McConnell, and I'm Anna Lee McConnell in Juneau, representing the administration on the commission, and trying to keep awake after all the work we've been doing on the budget lately.
Brad Pierce, staff.
Melissa Faust, staff.
Why don't you bring one of those mics? You have to speak pretty directly. No, the other one.
The other one.
Yeah, right after there. No, after you. Yeah. Okay. Why don't you go ahead and speak first?
Cameron Cook, observer.
Good morning, Cam.
Hello, Melissa.
11:30.
A couple of items on the agenda. We had originally scheduled the permanent fund presentation for 9 a.m. Due to airplane schedules, that's going to be at 11:30. Where I had hoped to do the permanent fund constitutional amendment first, I'm going to wait. I want to wait until we've had the opportunity to hear from Michael O'Leary, the permanent funds asset allocation advisor, and the person who we had on the line during our work. Pat, do you want to say a few words so that the people doing the transcription understand who's talking when you talk?
This is Pat Porchot. Can you hear us here?
Yes. The what we'll do then is begin working through the legislation and come back around to the permanent fund issues. We may have some information concerning state revenues as well. Anna Lee, do you know what time that might be available for discussion?
How about maybe right after lunch?
Okay.
Or right after the permanent fund?
Okay, that sounds good. Let's start then looking through the bill packet, and I'd like to take them sort of in the order that we've always discussed them, beginning with the tobacco tax. We have a bill draft with a bill analysis and Department of Revenue commentary. The bill draft is an act relating to taxes on cigarettes and tobacco products. First section of the bill increases the excise tax per cigarette from 12 mils to 62 mils. The second section increases the excise tax on wholesale price of tobacco products from 25 to 100%. And the third section provides for the indexing of this amount every 2 years based on the CPI. The memo from Legislative Council just shows the describes how they've gone about this. The current version puts a portion into the school tax fund and the rest into the general fund. This bill keeps the same amount in the school tax fund, and the additional dollar a pack all goes into the general fund. Does anyone have any comments on this, whether this one meets what our intent was? Questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Mary.
Attachment of Bartholomew's memo to Brad suggests that we look at the comments regarding the CPI adjustment that are attached to the motor fuel tax. And it appears that both the Department of Labor and the Department of Public Safety want to be out of the firing line with respect to raises in the taxes. And they also call some attention to some complications with respect to references to whatever CPI it is that is to be used. One of the things that I found of interest also was that the Department of Public Safety says they need 6 months in order to do whatever it is that they need to do administratively to incorporate the raises in the fees. So I think that what we need to do is to make sure that if we're going to do this CPI adjustment, that we conform all of the bills to a particular standard so that nobody, and we clarify how the procedure is to work so that all of the adjustment is based on the same set of parameters.
I would agree with that and would propose that we consider that the CPI adjustments take effect on July 1st of each year based on the CPI as of the previous October 1st, which gives 9 months after the CPI comes out to make the adjustments, with the exception of when we get to the motor vehicle license fees, which are done on an annual calendar year basis rather than on a fiscal year basis, but that the taxes be done on a fiscal year, July 1 increase each year.
Well, if I understand it correctly, Mr. Chairman, apparently the Department of Public Safety is saying that they need 6 months, they need lead time, to make adjustments for fee increases, which would be the same lead time every time the CPI adjustment was made. So if they need 6 months in order to make that adjustment, if the adjustment is made as of October 1st when the CPI comes out, they would need 6 months, which would take it into the middle of a calendar year. So I'm wondering if it shouldn't be the following January 1 if they want a calendar year, and I think that's appropriate under the circumstances, if they want a calendar year.
Well, I think that doesn't apply to the cigarette and tobacco, but when we get to the motor vehicle license, we're going to have a separate discussion on how it would work for those. But for those that are tax increases, if they know on October 1st, there should be no problem implementing
right.
on July 1st.
Right.
Pat, did you have your hand up? Or?
No, I'm just chewing on my pen, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, okay.
He's trying not to get addicted to tobacco.
Good.
Somehow I missed the public safety memo. Mary, where's the public safety memo?
It's a memo that's attached to
motor vehicle
registration fees, and it's a memo from Ann Carpinetti to Deborah Bear.
Oh, in Ann's. I'm sorry.
Okay. Yeah, and it's on the second. page under, well, first and second.
That's it.
Okay.
Number 8.
Right.
Yeah, I didn't miss, I'm sorry, I missed that.
Judy?
I'm assuming, maybe I'm assuming wrongly, so I'm assuming that what we, that kind of our job is to see that the bill is, does what we intended to do in terms of taxes and things. But like Mary, I'm concerned about, you know, timing and all those issues. Mary just knows a whole lot more about it than I do. I just know enough to be concerned. But I was kind of assuming that the legislature, when in their hearing process, would fine-tune that kind of thing, and that the information from the bill attachments that we have would also go to the legislature so they could see. And in those instances where we know, where we've been told, you know, we make the adjustments that we can here, but because we only have 3 or 4 hours to do this, that we essentially pay attention to, is this something that fits, that does what we, mm-hmm. is a piece of the plan that we had voted for?
Well, but Judy, I think we need to ensure that when we're doing CPI adjustments, that we use the same standards.
Yes, and I don't disagree with that.
Because I think that as a bill goes through the legislature, we could get tweaks that are going to be a mess.
Absolutely.
Okay. I'd suggest, based on the implementation time, that we consider an effective date on the tobacco tax bill. I don't know how quickly a tobacco tax can go into effect, and there didn't seem to be any discussion from revenue. As the bill stands here, the tax would go up 90 days after it was signed by the governor, and it may be that a fixed date would be more useful. And I don't know, perhaps someone from the administration would know if how much time we want to have elapse prior to this coming into effect.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Pat, I don't know what the exact time is, but I had a conversation just in general with revenue several months back. They reminded me that I'd forgotten that we do currently, of course, have a cigarette tax, we have an alcohol tax, we have a motor fuel tax. They didn't act like it was, a very hard chore to change the rate of that tax. The mechanisms for charging it and collecting it, of course, are already in place.
Mr. Chairman?
Mary?
One of the things we have to take into account is that private industry really is our tax collector on this, and there are an awful lot of vending machines and that kind of thing that are going to have to be adjusted. And so I think that it would be extremely helpful to private industry to give them a fixed date on which the tax would go into effect, so they would know what their deadline is, and give them perhaps a little more than the 90 days that would normally be available without another effective date.
Does anyone want to propose a date on the tobacco tax?
I would propose January 1. It doesn't really matter if it goes into effect in a mid-year.
For ease of we're trying as much as possible to get things in sync of where it doesn't disrupt the public, to get things in sync with the fiscal year. It just makes our projections and so on cleaner and our budget stuff cleaner. I don't have so much a problem with an effective date that doesn't start on July 1st for this year if we need lead time. But one thing that would be helpful is if we say, even if it takes some initial lead time for the first go-around, by that time the public is on notice that the increases in succeeding years would happen on July 1st. That would help from our end.
Yeah, I think I heard no objection to July 1st for all of the CPI adjustments. Is there objection to January 1st, 97 as the effective date? On this
Mr.
one,
Chairman,
Pat?
Just in terms of the commission's calculations on our spreadsheets, knowing that, you know, there's lots of problems with the numbers as far as, you know, plus and minus there. I don't think that the commission spreadsheet calculated only a half a year revenue, did they?
We calculated a full year revenue on the tobacco tax, and I think that for us to put a later effective date, because we think it makes more sense administratively, while it would have a minor change on the revenues, I think that would be acceptable. I wonder if maybe October 1st might work better for this, just because we already have a tax in place.
I would go for that.
Other thoughts?
That's fine.
I just think January 1 is a better deal because there are going to be so many problems that industry is going to encounter with this thing.
Mike, do you have a preference?
No.
Okay, we have, in Anchorage, we have two October 1sts, one January 1st, and one no preference. What about in Juneau?
Two for October 1st. Pat, I believe the room for just a moment.
Okay. So where we are on this one will be adding an effective date of October 1st, 96. And
96
for the first one.
96.
And then the future changes would be effective on July 1st of every odd-numbered year, based on the percentage change in the CPI.
Brian, Matt, are we going to change even-numbered year to odd-numbered then?
Let's see, if we're coming in 96, no, it should be even-numbered year, that's right. So the amounts would change on July 1st of each even-numbered year.
Okay.
So instead of October 1, it would be July 1.
Yes.
So the next change then would be in 98.
Correct. Now, did we also, on the cigarette tax, have an increase? Have a triennial increase of 25 cents?
I thought we did.
Yes, we did.
Do we want to put that triennial increase into this bill or leave that to the future legislatures? My preference would be to leave it to future legislatures so that we don't have in section one here, a section that says it's 62 mils that's effective on October 1st, 96, and then a repealer of that and a reenactment to say 75 mils that's effective on another date, et cetera. I guess my preference would be not to try to do all of the step-ups in this bill, but I'd be open to other thoughts on that.
My thought are, you don't do it now, it won't get done.
Well, isn't that taken into account in section 2 of the bill, where it steps up the excise tax from 25 to 100?
That works on the tobacco, the non-cigarette tobacco products.
Oh, okay.
So the non-cigarette tobacco products will go up with wholesale price increases, but they don't go up further, nor does the cigarette tax go up further according to we had 99, 2002, and 2005, if I remember right, in 25-cent increases.
Okay.
Judy?
I guess I agree with Mike on this, that the legislature can always take it out. If we don't put it in, it'll not happen again. It's too hard. It's too hard to do incremental increases like that. And so I think we should put it in. That's part of our budget plan. And
well, it's going to be a bad scramble with a lot of lobbying on this bill anyway, and they might just well get it all over with in one session instead of postponing the agony.
Yeah, right.
I agree. I'd like to see it all done at once.
We heard that from other people, right?
Okay, so that the proposal that I'm hearing majority on is that we would say that it's 62 mills from October 1, '96. It goes to 75 mills on July 1, '99. It goes to 87 mills on July 1, 2002, and it goes to 100 mills on July 1, 2005, plus CPI adjusters. Is that?
That's what everybody voted on. I think it's dumb.
Why don't we do a? Why don't we just do up to $3 and cap it? Is that what happens?
Well, one.
So it seems to me,
Annalee.
Sorry, it seems to me that this case is a little bit different than some of the other fee things that we talked about, where we thought indexing was important, because in the case of the motor fuel, we were talking about trying to keep pace with inflation. And what we've suggested in our plan of going from $1, $1.50, et cetera, is something that is not related to inflation. So it seems to me that it could be appropriate in this case, and we didn't bank on it in our calculations, to substitute a specific dollar increase for the CPI increase. And I think if we load the two, we begin to sound preposterous.
So should we then just take out the indexing, the CPI indexing, and go with an increase of 12 mills every 3 years?
Well, Mr. Chairman, my recollection is that the commission was very favorable to Kay Brown's bill, which included indexing. And when I asked the question about it's creating, some administrative problems, everybody just dismissed it. And so my understanding is that it was both indexing and these incremental increases that the commission endorsed.
Judy?
Well, I think essentially what the commission endorsed was, you know, this added money that we could get for cigarette tax, and we were moving pretty fast then. So I think the essential thing is whatever we want to do, we put in this bill or we use Kay's bill or something and just go. I mean, it's going to get worked over. You know, the legislature is
I'd rather see just the incremental increases than the CPI adjustments, because I think ultimately you wind up with more money.
Yeah, let's just vote for that.
Okay, the proposal from Mary is that we just go with the 12 mills every 3 years increase in the cigarette tax. Is there opposition? So this is more than inflation. More than CPI on the cigarette tax.
So are we dumping Section 3?
Right. We're dumping Section 3 and replacing it with an artfully drafted increase of 12 mills every 3 years.
You know, what we might want to consider is saying that once we get to that final stage, that from then on it should be indexed, so that, I mean, if the point is to get it to a certain level for policy reasons, then for that level to remain an effective level over time, you would want to index it.
I guess, Annalee, I would prefer to just let it keep increasing at 12 mils every 3 years, which gets it. I mean, we get from 1996 at the dollar up to 2005 $1.75. I think there was a lot of sentiment on the commission that we could keep going after that, and you know, so we're effectively every 12 years adding a dollar.
Let the future take care of itself. I mean, ours is supposed to be a 10-year plan. For God's sake.
So, I refuse to worry past 2050.
Okay, so what's the... Are we doing three increases over 9 years, or are we doing increases every 3 years until the legislature changes it?
Why don't we just do, you know, every 3 years?
Yeah.
You know, if...
when it gets too high, they can stop.
That's right. And also, it may very well be a revenue loser instead of a revenue gainer at that point. So.
Okay, so the amendments to this bill will be an effective date of October 1st, 96, and then on July 1st, 99, and every 3 years thereafter, a 12 mil increase in the excise tax on cigarettes.
Right.
Are there any objections? If not, we'll that completes the work on the tobacco tax. Let's go to alcohol taxes. Let me just interrupt for a second and ask Pam Cook. Pam, if you have any questions as we go along, feel free to raise them, since you and your staff get the wonderful job of taking our broad concepts and putting them into real words.
Well, with that invitation, can I go back to this excise tax portion of the bill that we just completed and
yes.
ask you to point out that having gotten rid of the tax adjustment in Section 3, you no longer are adjusting the excise tax at all?
And that would mean that for other tobacco products other than cigarettes, it would remain at 100% of the wholesale price. Is that correct?
Well, the motion, as I understood it, was to eliminate Section 3. Perhaps the motion should have been to eliminate only the reference to 4350-190A out of Section 3, in which case you're keeping your tax adjustment for the excise portion. I don't know. It's just a question I raise.
I think that's our intent.
Okay.
I think you're right. Thank you. One down. Alcoholic beverages. I have a question on this one. One of the issues we discussed on the excise taxes on alcoholic beverages was trying to get rough equivalency on a per drink basis between beer, wine, and hard liquor. And I'm not sure exactly how you get that, except to maybe look at what the effect of the per drink price is here. If we take a beer is 12, we've got 128 ounces in the gallon, is that correct? Anybody know that off? That's the number I remember. So that would say there are 10 cans of beer in a gallon. So under this proposal, we're looking at about 10 cents per drink on malt beverages. The average wine is a 5 ounce, and so there are 25 drinks per gallon on wine. So if we take $2.15 divided by 25, We're at 8.6 cents per drink on wine. And how many ounces in the average?
Well, 750
mixed drink.
Milliliters is
what, 1.5 ounces. So if we say 128 ounces in a gallon divided by 1.5, there are 85 drinks per. And we're at 15 cents per drink on hard liquor as this bill stands. And I had hoped we'd try to get the three.
Yeah, let's do
three
that.
Into line, roughly. If we were aiming for about 12 ounces in a can of beer, 5 ounces in a glass of wine, and 1.5 ounces in a mixed drink.
Right, but what did your little numbers come up with?
So that came out that if there are, so in a gallon, there are 10 bottles of beer, there are 26 glasses of wine, and there are 85 mixed drinks. So we come up with 10 cents a can, 8.5 cents for a glass of wine, and 15 cents for a mixed drink.
To drop the mixed drink
then? Or raise them all to be to come out at about 11 cents, perhaps?
Why not 10 cents? It's easier.
Okay, if we did 10 cents, then then we stay with $1.05 for beer. We go with $2.50 for a gallon of wine. And $8.50 for a gallon for other beverages.
I think that meets what we set out to do.
Mm-hmm. I think so.
I think that's equity among drinkers. Consumers, I should say.
Drinking.
Okay, so we're at $1.05, $2.50, and $8.50. Then we have a tax adjustment, and again, we'd be looking at every even-numbered year, indexing the tax effective July 1st of each even-numbered year.
And then we need to change the date of notification. Maybe from June 30th to March 1st?
Yes. And we change the effective date here again also to October 1st, 96. Now, if I remember right, on the alcohol tax, we also had increases above the inflation rate. Look at our spreadsheets here. The alcohol tax increased triennially. So we had them indexed, and then they went up every 3 years by about 3. Looking at the report, in today's dollars, it was steady for 3 years at $19 million, and then it jumped to $22 million for 3 years, and then it jumped to $25 million. since inflation's taken out, we had indexing plus an additional boost. Tam, is there, if we wanted to do another increase of about, if we wanted to do another increase every 3 years in addition to the indexing, is there an easy way to write that?
Yeah, it looked like a stair-stepping sort of a situation. You just have to build it into the statute what years the increase occurs. I don't know if there's an easy way to calculate the tax adjustment with the increase also. I mean, it might be administrative burden, but...
Couldn't you start with, say, the numbers that we have here, let's say $1.05 for beer, and assign a fixed number of the increment so that the CPI does not affect that raise. In other words, in 3 years it goes up to $1.10 for beer and a comparable adjustment for the other types of alcohol.
What we'd be looking for is that in addition to the indexing, on July 1st, 99, and every 3 years thereafter, the alcohol, the beer tax would go up by 25 cents, the wine tax by 65 cents, and the other beverages tax by $2.10 per gallon. If I've calculated this correctly, that 25 cents, 65 cents, and $2.10 keeps the relative per drink price would go up by 2.5 cents every 3 years on top of inflation.
Mr. Chairman?
Mary?
Tam, while you're thinking about that, let me ask you another question. Sub D, as in Denver, of Section 2 of the bill, talks about promulgation of regulations. And it talks about every June 30, a change in regulation, which would take effect then on July 1, which is a day. Is there a way of crafting the legislation in such a way that we don't have to go through regulation, but there could be some kind of an announcement? If we could schedule enough in the bill so that we could avoid regulation, can we just do a notice provision so that the wholesalers and retailers are noticed of the rise in the tax?
There's no reason why that couldn't be done that I'm aware of.
Well, I would like to see us given that an experiment because the regulatory process itself is expensive and there's no reason to eat into potential revenues by screwing around with regulations.
What you really need then is a single regulation which provides for that notice process. And
well, I think the statute needs to provide for the notice process, and then you don't even have to do the regulation.
Mary, I think that's an excellent suggestion.
How about making these consistent between the two bills?
All
yes.
of them that have this CPI thing.
You know, from a practical standpoint, since the CPI is announced on October 1st, it would be our intention, I think it only makes sense, to include the new numbers as part of both the fall forecast each year and also as part of the budget document. So, practically speaking, we would be including these things in the budget that's that's presented on December 15th, you could maybe have an announcement at the same time that the budget is put out.
Yeah, do you need any changes to Title 37 or anything like this that would make that a statutory component? Do you need it? Because if you do...
I don't know that we would need it, but maybe if... What if in the overall indexing provision, we've specified the method by which all of the fees that are indexed would be published in a list, or, you know, whatever, published as part of the budget document, and then would that work, Pam? And then it could be, you know, just one of the charts within the budget document that would say, here are the fees that would be commencing on the fiscal year.
You might want to have a... What did you say, Tam?
I was going to say, I don't think you need to address that all in statute. All you need to do in statute is to direct the department to give an adequate notice of change in amounts and let them figure out how to accomplish it. They want to put it in budget documents, they want to put it on the front page of the paper, they want to write letters to every citizen in the state, leave it up to them. As long as we've given them a directive to make this information available to the public, that's really all we need to do as far as the statute goes, I should think.
And to avoid writing regulations.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, anything else on the alcohol tax? Let's go to motor fuel. And we have a new draft that has both marine and...
Yes, we do. It should have been on the statute stuff.
Pam, I have a question, a clarification, Brian, before we move on.
Go ahead.
On the how long we want to have this triennial increase go on. Perpetuity, three times?
I think this one also is until the legislature changes it, that triennial increase stays in effect. There will be a point at which tax revenues will begin to decline, and we don't know what that point is, and I think the legislature will want at that point to repeal the change. Okay, the next one is a bill relating to the tax on transfers or consumption of motor fuel. This one increases from 8 to 21.9 cents motor fuel, and from 5 to 8 cents the watercraft. It provides that the off-road goes from 6 to 15.9 cents. And it provides for the indexing. Again, we'll want to change the indexing date to July 1st of each even-numbered year. We'll want an effective date for the bill of October 1st, 96. I have a question on this one that was raised in the discussion from the Department of Revenue from Bob Bartholomew. He notes that we have a gasohol exemption, which costs us $13 million in lost revenue. Is there any... The national legislation exempting gasohol was done to encourage production of non-petroleum-based fuels. Can anyone think of a policy reason why Alaska would want to exempt gasohol?
I can't, but since I know so little about it, I don't think the fact that I don't know of one counts for anything. If you'd like, we could make a quick call over to DOT and see if there's any information that they could provide on that.
Do we have any idea how much gasohol is sold in Alaska? My guess is very little.
Well, according to this, 60 million gallons.
Well, that's not very much. How much is the total sold?
Well, I don't know, but that's 60 million gallons at 21 cents a gallon. It's $13 million.
Yeah, but isn't this something that they talk to companies and, you know, they had to talk to companies to be doing?
We've got Sam Keto here from the Department of Transportation. Maybe you can help us on this.
Okay. The total gallonage sold for gasohol or exempted for gasohol is approximately 60 million. We sell in the neighborhood of the...
Can you come a little closer to the mic? I've got everything but the dollar amount that you said, Sam.
It was 60 million gallons. At present, last year, the exemption cost the state approximately $2.4 million. The exemption was only, actually, the sales of gasohol in the large market Anchorage area only took place over 2 months. This year, it'll be the whole season, so we're expecting that amount to double to $4.8 million, a potential loss of $13 million if we increase the tax to 21.9 cents.
Is there any policy reason to exempt gasohol from the department's standpoint?
Not a full exemption. If you look at pretty much nationwide, in the western states, there is no exemption for gasohol. Some of the Midwest states, they have smaller exemptions of between 1 and 3 cents per gallon for gasohol.
Judy?
Is this the one... fuzzy on this. Is this the one, though, that like Anchorage voted that they had to have because of air quality? Isn't this the kind of thing that they had to have and the companies, nobody wanted to do it and they said you have to do it? Here it is.
Right.
And so that's why that's why they exempted from tax, because they already hit them with, you know, you have to have different tanks, you have to do all this other stuff. And so they went ahead and, because they told them they had to, went ahead and made the investment. Part of the deal was that they would say, okay, if you do this, we'll, you know, at least do this much.
Actually, the exemption was already in place prior to that.
Okay, but that was part of the deal, but nobody wanted to do this. This was the kind of thing where they said, okay, for clean air, you have to do it, even though they argued no one else in the country has to do it but us. So,
Mr. Chairman, we talk about 60 million gallons of gasohol, but what are we talking about? Regular gasoline.
Total sales of gasoline, including the gasohol gallons, is in the neighborhood of 419 million gallons, which includes gasoline and diesel.
So we're talking roughly 10% of the market. 10-15% of the market is gasohol. And
Mr. Chairman, they do only have to sell the gasohol in the winter a lot. The comments that was made by Department of Revenue is they feel that they might actually extend the gasohol selling season because they're already producing the product.
Well, on this one, I'd rather wait until make a note, have the legislature look at it, because we don't know enough. But I know they didn't want to do it to begin with, and we're told you have to. And you have to do it for this season, and so, you know, that's a little different than coming in and...
I guess my concern in not having a tax on gasohol is that to the extent that we've already put in production facilities for gasohol, to the extent that what we have is a lower tax on gasohol, or no tax on gasohol versus 22 cents on gasoline, we may be tending to push consumers toward the tax-free product, and that we end up promoting gasohol to an even greater extent and accelerate our revenue losses. Recognizing we don't know a lot about this, I guess I'd rather remove the gasohol exemption and then in the letter say we've removed it because we think taxes that people who drive vehicles with gasohol still tear up our roads, and we need that money for the road maintenance. And we think the legislature ought to look at it further, and if some exemption, similar to, say, the off-road exemption or something like that, is required, that the legislature could back off. But I think it's going to be hard for the legislature to add a tax. It may be easier for them to delete a tax.
Well, The only thing I think, if you tell somebody you want them to do it, you know, we're doing the cigarettes and the alcohol for social reasons. If we said socially, we want you, you have to do this because it's good for the air, even though every study has, you know, but you have to do it anyway. And then to say, okay, we're going to add. And you only have to do it in the winter because that's when you get the most pollution. I mean, the thing is screwed up to begin with in terms of...
That's true. Kind of as a side note, and I'm not 100% clear on this, but my impression was that the gasohol requirement in Anchorage was similar to the oxy-fuel requirement because of a non-compliance and EPA requirement that urban areas meet certain air quality standards.
But it's still the only place in the country where the the assembly actually said you have to. I mean, it's done differently every place else. So I just think...
Yeah, but Mr. Chairman, that's a, the Anchorage Assembly. And I think that, you know, we need to... The whole impetus behind this dramatic rise in the gas tax was because of the recognition that our roads are in dreadful condition and we're not allocating a sufficient sum of money to maintenance. And I agree with Brian that... car driven by gasohol is just as likely to tear up the roads as one that's driven by gasoline or any other petroleum product. I'd like to see it all uniformly taxed, and if the legislature wants to give an incentive, then let them.
Mike, any thoughts on this?
Same as Mary's.
Pat, gasohol exempted or not exempted?
Mm-hmm. Not exempted. I think that the original, maybe that this was mentioned earlier, but I think the original purpose was as, you know, obviously alternative fuel incentive. Now we know that it doesn't cost anything more to make it, and it's readily available.
Well, I sense there's a majority to remove the gasohol exemption, gasohol at the same rate as other motor fuels. If we want to do something for social engineering on this, I'd like to propose a $10 a gallon tax on fuel containing MBTE.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. Double dirty.
I don't believe that there's been any scientific evidence on that whole thing. I think you guys in Fairbanks just suffer from more psychological and physical problems.
How about mental?
I think we need a tax on people who make negative comments about Fairbanks.
Oh, you can do it if you live there.
It would
be a big revenue generator here in Anchorage, I know that.
Fairbanks and Juneau, too.
Okay, so on the motor fuel, our changes are to add a section that deletes the gasohol exemption and to change the date to July 1 for the indexing, to have the effective date October 1 of 96. Any other changes?
Brian, Anna Lee asked me to bring up one idea here, whether we needed this to be 21.9 cents and 15.9, whether it couldn't just be 22 and 16.
We've been using 22 in all of our public presentations. 22 and 15.
15 or
16? 16. Okay. That takes care of motor fuel tax. Motor vehicle registration fees, I believe, is our next one. And on this one, we've had some questions raised by the Department of Law. We've got the bill as it's currently drafted has Department of Labor adjusting the fees. They don't want to do it. They want public safety to. Public safety thinks that labor should publicize the fees. I believe that public safety, as the department responsible for collecting the fees, is the one that ought to be responsible for publicizing it, and that public safety is the appropriate agency. I agree with the public safety position that the fees should go up January 1, '97. The other suggestions from the Department of Law, maybe we ought to go through them one by one and go through and see where the sense of the commission is. Section 1 of the bill, which amends 108B, says that we should repeal this rather than amend it, since the original staggering of registration follows 2810-108C. Does anyone understand what this means?
Yeah, I think that what they used to have all of the licenses expire at one time, and now they rotate them on a monthly basis. So I think that what Mike did on this draft is look at one section without realizing
okay.
practice had moved on.
Tam, do you have any problem with the suggestion in section one? I mean, in comment number one of Ann Carpinetti's memo?
I don't think I understand it, but someone will.
Okay. I the intent of the commission is that whoever's right on this is the way it goes. Is that it?
Prevails. Right always prevails.
Okay. Number two, section four of the bill repeals the exemption for disabled vets, other handicapped persons, conforming amendments required in 181D. I assume that's okay with everyone. And the same in section three. We need a conforming amendment in 181E. Section 4 repeals the registration fee exemption. They still have distinctive plates, and it doesn't refer to the charges for the plates. I guess my assumption on this one, or my proposal on this one, would be that we use the same $10 one-time fee that's used on a historic vehicle. Does anyone have a proposal for a different number on that?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. Why did you choose that as opposed to National Guard or Vets license and fees?
The reason for that is if you look at the bottom of page 3, the existing language on the amateur mobile radio station vehicle, the top of page 4, basically what the existing law recognizes that amateur radio provides a service to the public in a time of emergency. And so I picked the lowest level, recognizing that ongoing service to the public provided by the vehicle that's that carries the mobile amateur radio station. But I could go with any, I just picked the number to get the discussion started.
Okay.
How many are there?
Lots.
Amateur radio,
now, these people would pay, under this, they'd pay a one-time $10 fee, plus they'd pay whatever the registration fee is for the vehicle. We're not saying it's only that one-time fee for the license plate of $10.
Well, you know, everybody in an emergency who can help, helps.
Well, these people do perform some
do
services, especially in the non-urban areas, Judy, that you wouldn't get otherwise. There aren't a lot of cops on the road. There are no AAAs.
Yeah, but everybody's got now, everybody's got CBs and they help.
I refuse to have one in my car.
I know, but everybody but you has one.
You know that,
and they help each other and call for help, and, you know, people help each other.
Judy raises a good point. There's been a technological change here that many of the vehicles I see driving around Anchorage and Fairbanks have cellular telephones, and people are calling in accidents on their cell phones. When this was originally enacted, we didn't have cellular phone service. Is this an outmoded section of the statute?
Sounds like it to me.
Well, then why don't we...
Do they get special plates?
Yes, they get special plates that have their call letters.
Mr. Chairman, I would put them in the same fee schedule as on page 3, section 4, D2.
Is there any objection?
No, but Mr. Chairman, all of D1 and 2, it seems to me, ought to have the same fees. The historic vehicles are toys. There's no reason to give them a preferred rate as opposed to people who have handicap plates or anything like that. So I'd just say we set them all at $30 and let them get them.
Yep.
Proposal is that
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Pat?
Yeah, I think there's a different rationale there. I don't think it was any kind of special recognition for those car owners. I think it was a recognition that they don't use the roads. That, they rarely use the roads.
They're only out for parades, basically.
Yeah.
They're in Fairbanks all the time, all summer long. People drive their old cars because it's fun, and they're using the roads. I think that it's a pleasure craft. You have to pay the same license fee for boats. You only use them in the summertime.
Now, what this says, I'm rereading this under Section 4. The special registration fees are imposed annually. The historic vehicle is a one-time only $10. Under 2, Alaska National Guard personnel pay $30 annually, and I guess that's in lieu of the regular vehicle fee on all of these. Is that right? That's in addition to the... that's right, because they were all exempted from the regular fees.
Why don't we just not exempt anybody and just... go for it.
And offer them special plates if they want to.
If they want to pay for it.
Extra.
Well, there are a couple of these that are like the dealer plates. So we have annual fees on all the vehicles under sections 2 and 3. And then section 4, some of these are annual, some of these are one time only, some of these are never. And some of these are these fees plus the regular fees. That would be the special request university plates.
You know, I just think this whole thing has turned into a junkyard of stuff, and you know, you go to the state of Washington, pay $385 for, you know, every year, and here we pay $35. I just think we should just say everybody pays the same, everybody uses the roads, everybody pays for the roads, and let's not turn this into a anything other than everybody pays, and that's the end of it.
So one way of drafting that would be to take the schedule we have in Section 2. We would need to add snow machines, move snow machines and farm machines into that section with their annual fees doubling from the current $5 for a snow machine to $10 and $35 to $70, and then say that that's it for all vehicles, is that annual schedule, and that at the time of registration for any special license plate, you pay an additional $30 one time only to get the special plate. If you take the next plate in line, you don't pay the extra $30. If you have a special request plate, regardless of what it's for, it's $30. One time only in addition to the...
Okay, what happens to you?
And I assume that by...
Annalee?
No, go ahead. Well, I assume that by one time only, mean that if we change over all of our plates and they have an opportunity to get a new fancy plate, then they pay again. But as long as it's just the annual sticker going on the license plate, they're not paying again, right?
Correct. They're just paying the annual fee based on the size, the regular registration fee based on the size of the vehicle.
Would you just specify, you know, if there's a changeover of plates altogether, then they would pay again to get a special one?
Correct. And Mary, you were asking about the special request university plates.
Right.
That's currently a one-time fee of $50 that theoretically was collected and given to the university. It was collected but never given to the university. Most of those are out. So this section that was supposed to help the university never did.
Mr. Chairman, I would note that. Some of these that came later, like the veterans plates, those special plate fees actually make money. That they were, those are not subsidized, if you will. Those are actually we get more money than we actually pay in the cost of the plates.
And that's my assumption, that setting this $30 fee one time only makes us that money.
Yeah.
Tam, does that give you enough direction to give to Mike Ford on redrafting this?
I'm not sure it does, but Melissa can probably clear it up. I'm confused about what the relationship between D and B, I guess.
Okay.
Are they going to be paying... Are these registration fees in lieu of the normal ones are going to be on top of them, or what?
What we're suggesting is that under Section D, we would have one-time special registration fees upon initial registration for each special request plate for a historical vehicle, for National Guard, Veterans, Purple Heart, Custom Collectors, Special Request, University, etc., of $30 to get the special request plate, and everyone pays the same amount for all of their vehicles. We would move the snow machine section out of D into C. We'd move the farmer section out of D and into C. We'd move the dealer registration plates out of D and into C.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
If I could state this a little differently. Tam, what we're talking about is having annual registration fees set in the statute and then a separate section which allows people to buy vanity plates, special types of plates, which are an add-on, and they can buy them at any time. And every time they buy a new plate, pay $30 for it in addition to their annual registration fee. So that's really all we're talking about, is the schedule of annual fees plus special plates.
I have a question on passenger vehicles versus pickup trucks or vans. We have a distinction in the statute now. Does that really make sense? I mean, would we both simplify things, but also maybe make people feel a little better if we've got the same fee for a pickup truck, a van, a passenger vehicle? It's especially odd because, I mean, a motorhome is certainly a whole lot bigger and heavier than a pickup truck or a van, and yet it's at a cheaper rate, and the pickup truck and van, which many people own as their regular personal vehicles. Should we just make them all the same?
I'd go for that.
Well, one of the reasons why the distinction is there is because it was thought that commercial vehicles imposed a greater burden on the highway system or street system than passenger vehicles, even if they are pickups. So you may want to make a...
non-commercial.
These are only the non-commercial.
Right, but the weight of pickups, and of course there are a lot of little ones now, but in any event, the weight and utility of the vehicles was determined to be enough for additional charge. I don't know that it is. All I'm saying is that when we do make the change, we ought to know a bit about the rationale for what it was.
It seems like the commercial stuff is covered by weight, which I agree makes a lot of sense because that affects the road usage. That's covered in Section 3, different weights. The heavier you are, the more you pay for commercial. Seems like for personal vehicles, we might as well make motorhomes the same.
Right, but what about Domino's Pizza that runs around with a little tiny pickup?
They're paying based on weight on the lower part of the page.
Okay, all right.
Commercial.
Okay, all right.
So the proposal...
I shut my mouth.
Anna Lee, what you do is combine 1 and 2 at $75.
Yeah, probably would. I mean, I don't care that much between 70 and... From a fiscal standpoint, obviously, 75 would be better, but if people think that that just gets more flat, I wouldn't mind doing them all at 70.
Well, I figure half of them are at 70 and half at 80 and combine the two.
Probably about here. Sounds okay to me.
Okay, one more change. We're combining 1 and 2, simplifying so that you don't have to decide whether a vehicle's a light truck, whether a minivan is a van or a passenger vehicle. Okay. Anything else on motor vehicle license plates? Now, by moving, we've removed the exemption for a vehicle owned by the state. Yeah, but we're removing all Section D, we're saying one time. It's not worth collecting from one pocket to put into another pocket. Do we want to keep the state exemption? Collecting from one agency to give to another agency.
Anna Lee had to step out of the room. Normally, we don't find that particularly helpful. It just sets up more accounting system. All our agencies chart, you know, we go through this big highway working capital fund and the state equipment fleet. It typically creates more problems than solves them. I think we would argue to keep the exemption for state vehicles.
Any objection? Okay. That takes care of motor vehicle license plates. Now, on this one, we're not doing a July 1st. We're doing a January 1st at the request of the department. Is that correct?
All right.
Okay, let's go to automatic adjustments in fees and charges. This one does not apply to taxes, which are set by statute, but for fees and charges collected by state agencies. And in the analysis by Sarah Felix, Assistant Attorney General, she had a concern about Northern Lights Motel versus Sweeney. And I'd like to highlight at the bottom of page 2, she says, another way to achieve the goal would be to leave the statute as it is and adopt an administrative order directing agencies to adopt regulations amending their fees to reflect increases in the CPI.
What were we trying to accomplish here? What did this have to do with ours?
This was the trying to get the $3 million a year more in revenues from other fees that were out there, and
but I thought that was more like
indexing of all of those other fees that are out there.
And I thought that was, I thought mainly what we were aimed at was adding fees where there wasn't any.
Oh, okay, I had interpreted that to be adding fees that existed.
Because lots of the problem is that some agencies, some groups of users are paying no fees, and other groups of users are paying like big time fees. And the state needs to take a look at that. And so just increasing the fees of those people who already pay the fees may not be the entire answer. So I guess I would, you know, kind of look at the administrative order rather than the bill, because I really don't.
I personally,
Mr. Chairman,
go, Pat.
Yeah, I may have forgotten some of our discussions last summer, but I thought the $3 million didn't necessarily require legislation. And I agree with Judy that we're preparing legislation now. We'll probably have some kind of omnibus fee bill, and it's a real hodgepodge. Some state services are being very rigorously charged for, some are not so rigorously charged for relative to cost, and some are not charged at all. And an across-the-board attempt, I'm not sure we'd get at it. Additionally, some fees typically are, you know, they catch up at periodic intervals, and they're not just based on CPI considerations. So I'm not sure it lends itself to a fairly arbitrary CPI-based standard. I thought when we were talking that, we were really geared towards the tax side of it, which is really a revenue. When you get to the fees, the theory is, at least, you're doing a relationship between the costs of a service to the reimbursement for those services, so that it's not just a pure revenue source, if you will. And I think that the direction of the commission in terms of its plan would be, I mean, the charge to the administration at least, and to the legislature relative to new fee authority, would be that we would continue to look for new authorities for fees that should be charged that are not for services, that where the authority exists, agencies would be continuing to reevaluate periodically whether or not there was sufficient return for the cost of those services. But there's a whole, as everybody knows, a whole regulatory scheme to analyze, seek public input, and make decisions for each of those fee increases. And, you know, it has lots of wrinkles to it, but it does afford periodic, you know, public input and some rational approach to fee increases, as opposed to just annual or biannual arbitrary increases.
Does anyone on the commission object to pulling this bill from the package and instead requesting the administration to, by administrative order where possible, to deal with our fee increase?
I don't, except that the recommendation that for the administrative order says to the agencies adopt regulations, and I have some concerns that every time we turn around, we're directing agencies to adopt regulations. It's a slow, torturous, expensive process, and I think that what we need to do is more in line with what Pat was saying, set a goal and see what we can do about minimizing the requirement for regulations.
Any objection to that thought? Hearing none.
Mr. Chairman, I object.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Hey, Bob, how are you?
Yeah, I'll be sitting here keeping track of Mary. There is a problem in this, and there is a need for regulatory oversight on some of this stuff that Pat is talking about. For instance, this year we were doing business with Solid Waste Regulations, and they're trying to develop a fee schedule for that. And we had to comment a couple times to the commissioner of DEC, and it's nothing that you can unilaterally set a fee on in a forum like this or in the legislature. There's much more technicalities involved, whether you're dealing with a municipality-controlled solid waste deal or private property thing. And, I really would urge you to be careful in this area. I think I agree. I'm not a fan of the regulatory process, especially the way the Attorney General's office does it. Got one person there who keeps track of regulations, and we never get them cranked loose. But the point of it is that this is nothing that you can unilaterally just wave a wand at and put a fee on. And I would urge you to be a little cautious in this area, because there's many, many, many more examples of where the state really needs to charge a fee, but it's going to have to be done through a thoughtful process. Otherwise, industry and the public is going to react negatively to this idea of paying for the service of the state, which we vitally need to get fees charged for. So I urge you to be careful in this area, and hopefully, Mary, you'll understand a little bit more that we really do want to see a fee schedule develop, and we need more time.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with you, Bob, but what I was objecting to was just this rather blithe direction. The Attorney General's office is to just tell the agencies to go forth and start adopting regulations. I agree. I think when you're talking about a regulatory scheme like DEC has in place, you obviously have to have a very comprehensive regulatory process in order to arrive at fairness, let alone adequacy. But when we're talking about modest little fees for documents, that kind of thing, I just don't see this elaborate regulatory process having to be engaged in every time the CPI changes.
If I could try to, Pat, I guess this is really instructions to you and the administration in terms of dealing with this fee issue, and I guess the sense of the commission is that the administration should look for opportunities to increase fees, should try to keep the process for adopting as simple as possible while preserving the public right of input on the process, and that may be done by regulation in certain areas or by administrative action in other areas, depending on the nature. And I guess with a target out there, the administration can determine which things are done by regulation, which things you have to come in with statutory changes such as your omnibus bill, and which ones can be done through a simplified process. You comfortable with that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's not part of our package. Let's move on to senior citizen property tax exemption. The concern raised by the Assistant Attorney General has to do, Margie Vandoor, has to do with the financial need and whether we allow municipalities to each adopt their own determination, qualifying standards for financial need, whether this presents an equal protection problem. Otherwise, I would say that this received enthusiastic support at the Alaska Municipal League when I spoke there. Judy?
I think that I think that's something legislature could decide in the hearings. I know some communities do things that right now, that if this is a problem, then we've got a problem. I think let the legislature
Mary?
I think that I don't agree with this, the thrust of this Vander memorandum. I've never heard of the states being able to establish a needs base for property tax, for God's sake. And
yeah, I agree with that.
I think that the fact that varying municipalities can have different rates of sales tax suggests that within a particular area tax rates can be adjusted, and that's really all we're talking about is tax rates. So I agree. I think that we ought to eliminate the mandatory, allow them to do whatever they want to do on a voluntary basis, and if we want to make a recommendation, I'm not even pleased with the recommendation in terms of what the values should be. I think we ought to just eliminate the mandatory.
I agree, and don't say anything else.
Right.
Let the communities do what they want to do.
Exactly.
So in order to eliminate the mandatory, we have to give them the authority to do it, though.
Fine.
We can repeal the mandatory. There is, I think there is language in the optional that is okay. But in any event, if we ask for legislation that repeals the mandatory and simply grants boroughs and municipalities the option of accepting certain values, depending on what they want.
It looks to me that Section 2 keeps a mandatory of $75,000, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, and that's the thing. That's one of the things I object to on this.
We didn't intend that. So
no,
it's. I think one thing. What we have here is a markup based on an existing bill, and we need to get a new bill.
Right.
By rules, by request of the commission, and the intent of this is to remove completely any mandatory state. Any state-mandated exemption from local property taxation, and to allow local option for
certain defined classes of people, like veterans,
for the same three classes: 65 permanent real property owned by an individual and occupied by that individual who is 65 years of age or older, a disabled veteran, or at least 60 years old, and a widow or widower of a person who qualified for the exemption under 1 or 2. We didn't intend to make any changes in who was eligible, but just that a municipality may exempt up to $150,000 worth of property from those individuals.
But why do we have to do, why do we even have to say which class? Because the whole point is that if the municipality does it, they take the loss.
Because unless we allow them, under the uniform taxation, unless we specifically allow them to do that exemption, they can't.
Right.
That they may exempt any class of people if they're willing to
take
up the
loss. No, they can't.
I mean, we give them the ability to do anything they want as long as they take the hit. What do we care who they, what does the state care who people exempt?
I'll tell you what the state cares, is that you could have a circumstance where the local government could exempt all property owners except of housing and leave only, say, the oil properties in a borough paying a tax so that no owner of property, they could exempt every individual from paying a tax on his or her home and collect all their revenues from one industry. I think that's the reason that the state has tried to say specifically limit the exemptions. There's a homestead exemption of, what, $10,000 or something like that, that they knock off any residents, and then these are the only two currently allowed.
Well, I'm sold.
It really is a constitutional issue.
Yes. Pat?
Yeah. I had a question first. That I assume that the attorney's comments here only relate to this page 2, line 20, in case of hardship. That's the current existing law, right? She's not commenting on anything that we've done or recommended. Is that right?
Right.
Right.
I was going to say, and I know this is what you were getting at, Brian, it seems like the simplest, cleanest way to do this is you delete entire E, you just delete all everything there, you pick up back on section 3I, and you leave in that language. But it reads a municipality by ordinance may by ordinance exempt from taxation the assessed value of real property, and then delete all that exceeds the limits, blah blah blah, property, and then scratch all that, and then you leave in that current stuff that's deleted here. All you're saying is the state is saying, municipalities, it is permissible to grant some kind of real property taxation exemption if you're 65, if you're disabled, vet, or a widower.
Okay, so I would read something like, a municipality may by ordinance exempt from taxation the assessed value of real property if the real property is owned by an individual and occupied by as a permanent place of abode by that individual who is 65 years of age or older, disabled, veteran, at least 60 years old.
I think we are.
May I point out one thing? That if you write it that way, unless you say that the municipality may by ordinance exempt all or part of the value, you've given them a choice of either exempting the entire value of that. You don't give them a chance to say we're only going to exempt the first $150,000.
Okay, so I think we want to say all or part.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, and the other thing I want to point out is I believe the renter's rebate program is still on the books. I don't know if you guys want to address it in this bill, but this would be a vehicle to consider it. I'm not sure that it's been funded in the last few years. The renter's rebate program went along with this one, in theory, and that it was going to provide some aid to people in the same categories who were renters and not property owners, and it's currently funded, or supposedly funded by the state, so that the renters who fit in these same categories, being elderly or disabled or so forth, had the ability to go forward and actually get a check from the state. It was state money used for it. If we're going to eliminate the mandatory the mandatory nature of the tax provision that helps this category, perhaps some thought ought to be given to eliminating or maybe eliminating the renter's rebate portion. Seems like an anomaly to have the renter's rebate there as a mandatory thing in the, if you're going to eliminate the optional tax benefit.
Would there be any objection to the commission on the commission if we also allowed a municipality separately by ordinance to provide a renter's rebate program that provides equivalent benefits and to remove the mandate?
As long as it's the municipality's money and not the state's money, that'd be fine with me.
Yeah.
That is an important distinction because the programs are run differently now. There continues to be, up to now, last year at least, about $350,000, I believe, dollars appropriated separately for the renter's rebate program. That program, I believe, is actually paid through the state and through DCRA that people apply. The difference is the municipality loses money. It doesn't collect money from tax, but they do not have a line item in the municipality budget to pay renter's rebate.
Right,
that's been a state program. So
the municipalities have never paid renter's rebate. It's always come out of the state's pocket.
It's a little different budgetary dynamic there.
But it was intended to benefit the same class of people.
Well, yeah, but I don't think it's the state's responsibility to deal with local tax exemptions. You know, if we say it's permissible to grant tax relief, then if they want to strike a bargain in equity with another class, let them. But as long as it's not the state's money.